This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 139, Diadochoi. Today's the day. Finally, everyone really earns the title of Alexander's successors, plural. Today is the point of no return when everyone was forced to reckon with the fact that nobody would ever put all the pieces of Alexander's empire back together again. The last two episodes dealt with the inner workings of the newborn Seleucid Empire. They were about the differences in imperial culture from the Achaemenids and the internal relationships of the Seleucid royal family, especially the father-son-stepmother relationship playing out between Seleucus, his second wife Stratonike, and Stratonike's second husband, Antiochus, who was also the son of Seleucus. If you're feeling lost in that whole debacle, don't worry. I promise we are going to open up with an even more unhinged set of marriage politics in just a second. When we left our narrative, the Diadochoi had just divided up the empire again, following the Battle of Ipsus. The Seleucids took most of Western Asia, with a disputed territory in southern Syria and the Levant against Ptolemaic Egypt. Lysimachid Thrace expanded to include most of northern and western Anatolia. The Antipatrids kept Macedon and solidified their hold on Greece. Antigonus Monophthalmos was dead, but his son Demetrius Polyocrates carried on the Antigonid cause by raiding the Thracian coast from a few loyal bases scattered around the Aegean. Pleistarchus, Cassander's younger brother, had represented the Antipatrid interest at Ipsus, and as a reward, he was granted Cilicia, and some amount of power over Caria and Lycia. It's just not exactly clear whether he got all of that from Ipsus or if he moved around. The evidence for his reign in each place does not overlap. It's also unclear how exactly Pleistarchus, by definition an Antipatrid, related to his brother's kingdom in Europe. He sort of seems to have been an independent king, but they are also brothers. It didn't really matter that much, though. If you followed through the utter chaos of the early 3rd century BCE in the last two episodes, Cilicia might have set off some alarms for you, because in the last episode, Demetrius already had taken control there. So let's explain. In 301, everything was right in the world. the Diadochoi had come to an unsteady peace between their kingdoms. Ptolemy and Lysimachus even hammered out a marriage alliance. There was just one problem. Cassander got sick. Very sick. It's not clear with what exactly. The later historian Pausanias identified it as edema, or dropsy. But that's really just a symptom with a whole bunch of possible causes. My money is on some sort of horrifying sort of infection, since Pausanias says that maggots started hatching in his skin while he was still alive. Body horror aside, if you, like an ancient Macedonian, believe in divine omens, it's hard to find one more accurate than that, which frankly could be why it became part of the story. The Antipatrid house was still alive, but it was already rotting. I mentioned a few episodes back that Cassander ruled as a king, but never formally claimed the title. That's because his sons actually had a half-decent claim to the throne. Cassander was married to Thessalonike, one of Alexander the Great's half-sisters. And when Cassander died, his eldest son Philip became King Philip IV of Macedon. For all of 4 months before he caught tuberculosis and died. Then we run into a situation you might remember from the good old days of Artaxerxes II. Thessalonike favored her younger son, or possibly just herself. So when Philip died, she orchestrated things so that her middle boy, Antipater, and the youngest, Alexander V, would be co-kings. The trick was that Alexander V was probably still a teenager. So Thessalonike acted as his regent, effectively giving her the authority to overrule Antipater as well. King Antipater did the only thing that he could think of and had his own mother assassinated. Understandably, that scared Alexander. Fearing his brother, young Alex went looking for allies to help him make the first move. Fortunately, he had an ambitious but largely powerless duo hanging out in Macedon's backyard. Pyrrhus of Epirus and Demetrius Polyocrates. Now, Pyrrhus, last we saw him, was Demetrius' second-in-command in the Antigonid loyalist cities. In 298 BC, he tried to raid Ptolemaic territory and got himself captured. Pyrrhus became a political hostage briefly. When the opportunity presented itself, Ptolemy I had Pyrrhus marry his stepdaughter and gave Pyrrhus an army to retake the throne of his Epirot homeland. That went well, but Epirus was pretty small time in the grand scheme of all these kingdoms. Demetrius, meanwhile, was still kind of just a pirate. So the two of them reunited to help Alexander V take over Macedon. In the chaos of a succession crisis, Pyrrhus invaded from the west, while Demetrius occupied Plaistarchus by seizing Cilicia before joining the coup forces in Macedon proper. They won quickly. Antipater fled to Lysimachus in Thrace. Pyrrhus went home, happy to be on good terms with the new king of Macedon, and Alexander actually tried to poison Demetrius. However, the Antigonid king was getting pretty good at avoiding assassins by now, and escaped the toxic food. So instead, Alexander did the bare minimum required of one king to another, no matter how petty, and he had one last meal with Demetrius before the Antigonid was set to leave for Asia. Demetrius's guard swooped in and killed Alex V at dinner. Lysimachus then killed Antipater, mostly, I think, to get the Antipatrids out of the running altogether. And just like that, one of the main Diadochoi dynasties that we have been dealing with since Alexander the Great's death is gone. At long, long last, Demetrius and the Antigonid house swept into Pella as the rulers of Macedon in late 294 BC. It was a roller coaster couple of years, and quite frankly, does not really slow down. No sooner had Demetrius seized power than Seleucus took advantage of the chaos and his own recent divorce as an opportunity to invade and seize Cilicia along with all of its valuable shipyards. Demetrius didn't have time to react. He and his son, another Antigonus, called Antigonus Gonatus, for reasons lost to history, had to march south. The Boeotian League in Greece seized on this succession crisis as an opportunity to evict Macedonian rule. They too were defeated, but it took Demetrius 3 years to capture Thebes. In that time, he also married Pyrrhus's ex-wife. This was basically just adding some soap opera fuel to a fire already burning between Macedon and Epirus. After Alexander V's death, Pyrrhus felt threatened and betrayed by his former ally, and both sides started small-scale wars of raids across the border. Well, while Demetrius was burning through loyalty and manpower in Greece, his neighbors were hatching a scheme. Pyrrhus was right next to Macedon, and had a marriage alliance with Ptolemy. Lysimachus was right next to Macedon, and also had a marriage alliance with Ptolemy. Ptolemy the First Soter said, "Hey guys, I'll give you money and troops if you want to get rid of Demetrius." So they invaded. By 288 BCE, Demetrius' forces were once again forced to abandon their homeland and take on a defensive in southern Greece. That went poorly too, since Ptolemy had his navy sailing all over the region, supplying and aiding rebellions. Athens was in the mood to be an independent democracy again, too. Demetrius tried to besiege the great city of classical Greece, and that went nowhere. He was eventually forced to compromise. The Antigonids would retain some control of Attica, but Athens itself was a free city. Then Pyrrhus arrived with his army, and instead of compromising, Demetrius was chased out of Attica altogether. It was quite the heel turn from the city that had once proclaimed Demetrius a living god. And that's just the warm-up act, everybody. After a quick break, we will come back and see where this all ends up. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Now we can properly return to the Seleucid Empire because Demetrius was desperate to secure some sort of territory for himself, and he split his army. He left his son Antigonus Gonatas in command of the ongoing war against, well, against basically everyone to control Greece. Demetrius gathered 11,000 infantry, all of his remaining cavalry, and the scattered remains of his navy to sail for Anatolia. Demetrius Polycrates had a truly harebrained scheme in mind. Years earlier, he arranged for a marriage pact with Ptolemy through one of the King of Egypt's daughters. She had been sort of stuck in a marital limbo ever since. Well, this daughter was brought to Miletus when Demetrius arrived, and they had a quick wedding in a poor attempt to soothe things between Demetrius and the Ptolemies. Then, with reinforcement from his Anatolian loyalists, Demetrius's small army replicated every invading army's favorite tactic, a lightning assault against Sardis. It worked, he captured the Lydian capital, and started pulling reinforcements as some generals and soldiers betrayed Lysimachus to join him. So at this point, this is a war between Demetrius and Lysimachus. But Demetrius had a geopolitically insane plan. According to Plutarch, he made a desperate march across Phrygia, taking whatever territory he had to in order to reach Armenia. For some reason, Demetrius believed that from Armenia he could reach the Medes and spark an uprising against Seleucus in the upper satrapies. If I had to guess, he had some kind of old alliance with King Orontes III from back in the day when Antigonus was still the dominant power in West Asia. Needless to say, crossing some of the harshest terrain west of the Zagros was a bad plan at the best of times. 286 BCE was not the best of times. Demetrius's forces were hounded by the Lysimachid army as they raced across Anatolia, and desperation led to mistakes. While crossing a river, some of their rafts were so hastily made that they sank and drowned a number of Antigonid soldiers. Central Anatolia was also in the midst of a famine, making resources for the army scarce, and when tens of thousands of half-starving people exhaust themselves on the march and camp in close quarters for weeks on end, you get disease. They hadn't even reached Cappadocia when rumors of a mutiny forced Demetrius to turn south and seek refuge in Cilicia. Practically, Demetrius was out of options. He was going to lose everything to famine and pestilence if he didn't go south. But Cilicia was under Seleucid rule, and crossing the Taurus Mountains meant expanding the war to include Seleucus early. Militarily, it was a terrible idea. There just wasn't another option. They had already lost 8,000 of the original 11,000 infantry. So Demetrius wrote Seleucus a letter explaining the situation and apologizing for the semi-unintentional invasion. Of course, this had happened because Demetrius was trying to organize a rebellion against Seleucus, but he left that part out. Seleucus, for his part, was not a monster, and he was probably kinder than he should have been. The king in the east directed his governors and soldiers in Cilicia to share supplies with the Antigonids and save their lives. However, Seleucus's royal advisors cautioned against taking this too far. Demetrius was always, predictably, the most violently ambitious of the early Hellenistic kings. His presence was a threat. So Seleucus made a completely reasonable offer. He told Demetrius that his forces could stay in Cilicia for 2 months in order to survive the winter before moving on. They could go back to Greece, or return to their war with Lysimachus. Seleucus didn't care, and he wouldn't impede them either way. In the meantime, Seleucus just fortified the mountain passes between Cilicia and Syria as a precaution. Demetrius panicked and tried to conquer Cilicia again instead. So the Seleucid army marched in. To his immense credit, Plutarch says Demetrius successfully drove out this army, despite almost being amputated by a scythed chariot in battle, and he even managed to capture those fortified mountain passes. Then some sort of plague caught up with Demetrius, who was bedridden, halting his army's forward momentum. Still trapped in Cilicia, but now with no clear plan to continue the war, thousands of men deserted. But when Demetrius recovered, he still would not give up. He invaded Syria because, at this point, he just wanted to have a kingdom of some kind anywhere he could carve it out. With a full invasion underway, no matter how small, Seleucus came with his army in person. Antigonid deserters told him where Demetrius was camped out, and Seleucus took the army to face them, but he did not assault the Antigonid camp. Instead, King Seleucus dismounted, took his helmet off, and walked over to the enemy camp himself with nothing but a small shield. He called out to the mercenaries and soldiers who remained with Demetrius and politely asked them to give up, pointing out that it was he, Seleucus, who had fed and cared for them in Cilicia, and that they were woefully outnumbered. Most of Demetrius's men threw down their spears and went over to Seleucus. Demetrius and the small number of hardcore loyalists who remained with him fled into a nearby forest and tried to make it to the coast, seeking to get back to Greece. They could not travel by road because Seleucus posted guards. So even more people deserted, and within a few days of wandering through trees, Demetrius drew his sword and declared his intention for suicide. His closest remaining friends wrestled the blade out of his hands and begged Demetrius to surrender. Finally recognizing defeat, Demetrius the city besieger, diseased, dirty, and starving, turned himself in. Demetrius was given a king's incarceration inside a fortress with his remaining friends, and he was allowed to write a letter to his sons and allies still in Attica and Corinth, desperately trying to hold on to the scraps of Antigonid territory. Antigonus Gonatas offered Seleucus literally anything for his father's release. He offered to trade places, give up their cities in Greece, anything he could think of. Seleucus refused. Lysimachus offered Seleucus thousands of talents in Thracian gold if he would just kill Demetrius. But Seleucus liked Lysimachus even less and refused that offer too. Demetrius ultimately wound up a prisoner, and his wardens were his daughter and son-in-law, Stratonike, and crown prince Antiochus. This was a small comfort, and over the course of the next 3 years, depression drove Demetrius to inactivity. He died at 54 years old in 283 BCE. He wasn't one of our kings, but he was possibly the most chaotic monarch of the Hellenistic era. Back in Macedon, Lysimachus and Pyrrhus had split the kingdom between east and west. They were slowly picking away at Antigonus Gonatas' remaining strongholds. Then Lysimachus decided that he had enough of that arrangement in 284 and appealed to a very early sense of proto-nationalism, decrying Pyrrhus as a foreign interloper to build Macedonian support when he invaded East Macedon and kicked Pyrrhus out. He proceeded to invade and ransack Epirus, helped largely by the fact that during this whole war, Pyrrhus was stuck in a completely unrelated conflict with the Illyrians to his north. Unfortunately for Pyrrhus, this is where he exits our story, for the most part. But it's worth pointing out his future exploits. After the war with Illyria finished, he was down approximately one half Macedon, but saw an opportunity on the other side of the Adriatic Sea, in Italy. An upstart city-state called, Rome had defeated and occupied some Greek cities on the Tarentine Gulf, and the city of Tarentum was looking for allies against this invader. Pyrrhus made an alliance with two separate Ptolemies, more on that in a second, and sailed over to Italy with a large army to fight these Romans. He beat them badly at the start and besieged their city, Rome, but without the manpower to actually take it. He ultimately defeated them at the Battle of Asculum, but suffered heavy losses to do so, leading the Romans to develop a phrase, the Pyrrhic victory, for a victory that you technically win, but wasn't really worth the cost. At that point, Pyrrhus was actually offered the throne of Macedon again and turned it down in favor of invading and functionally conquering Sicily for a few years before another fight with the Romans forced him to go home to Epirus. Eventually, he actually did wind up back on the throne of Macedon, fought another war against Antigonus Gonatas, and died in a surprise twist besieging Sparta. In large part due to these later military exploits, Pyrrhus was long remembered as one of the greatest military commanders of the ancient world. Anyway, back to that issue of making alliances with two Ptolemies at the same time. I am so, so sorry, but try to focus on the surnames and epithets as we go here. Ptolemy the First Soter is the king in Egypt we have known for a while now. He made his first big appearance during Alexander the Great's siege of Halicarnassus. He was married at Susa, but divorced his Persian wife almost immediately in favor of an alliance with the regent Antipater via Antipater's daughter Eurydice. So that's Cassander's sister. She and Ptolemy had at least six children. Their daughters went off to form more of Ptolemy Soter's marriage alliances. And the only son you need to know for now is also named Ptolemy. This is Ptolemy Keranaus, eldest son of Ptolemy Soter, born around 320 BC. He was presumed to be his father's heir for most of his life, even after his father married the prominent Macedonian widow Berenike, a much younger woman and granddaughter of Cassander. This was another marriage pact that kind of renewed the Antipatrid-Ptolemaic alliance. Berenike had at least four children with Ptolemy, almost all of which will be important at some point. For now, worry about their first son, another goddamn Ptolemy. He will eventually be called Ptolemy Philadelphus. It's at this point that I need to point out that Ptolemy Soter's father was named Lagus. So this is very much a King Ptolemy problem, not a family tradition. Anyway, for unclear reasons, possibly related to Eurydice's own political leanings and how she influenced her son, or Berenike's growing influence at court and in harem politics, Ptolemy Soter changed his succession plans sometime around 287. Just as he started supporting the war against Demetrius in Macedon, Ptolemy Soter declared that Ptolemy Philadelphus was now his heir, and Ptolemy Keranaus was set into exile. Things only got more confusing and contested in exile. Kerenaus went to Lysimachus' court in Thrace, seeking an alliance to reclaim his throne. Lysimachus had multiple marriage alliances with Ptolemy, but that actually complicated things. Lysimachus himself was married to Philadelphus' full sister. Lysimachus' son was married to Caronaus' full sister. That meant that Lysimachus was more personally tied to Philadelphus, but the future of his kingdom was hypothetically tied to the exile Caronaus. And these two half-sisters were engaged in their own bitter political struggle for whose sons would inherit the throne in Thrace. Then Ptolemy Soter died in 284. Another one bites the dust, and Lysimachus had to make a choice. He went with the safe option. King Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, sent one of his daughters to renew the Lysimachid marriage pact. Caronaus was allowed to stay, but through his sister, got tied into the succession debate at the Lysimachid court, which resulted in his brother-in-law's assassination. Caronaus and his full sister fled to Babylon and the court of Seleucus, the only remaining Diadochus in power they had not personally offended. They also brought Alexander, one of Lysimachus' younger sons, and helped Seleucus form a plan and a cause for war. He would invade Lysimachid territory in Anatolia under the premise of placing Alexander on the throne and seize as much territory for the Seleucid Empire as possible in the process. The royal army assembled in Babylonia and set out across northern Syria, crossing through Cilicia and quickly carving a path northward to Sardis in the spring and summer of 282 BCE. Unfortunately, we do not know much about this war. It's just not a focus of any of the sources that survived. We even have a Babylonian chronicle that did describe it, but the part actually talking about the campaign is too damaged to read. Prince Antiochus remained in Bactria, a governor was left to run things in Babylon while Seleucus was away, and they left. When he reached Sardis, we do get some detail from Polyaenus. They besieged the city, but the Lysimachid general Theodotus had heavily fortified the old Lydian stronghold after Demetrius' brief occupation. So rather than wait through a prolonged siege, as the winter of 282 to 281 approached, Seleucus put a bounty on Theodotus, offering 100 talents of silver, over a full ton of precious metal, to whoever could kill the enemy general. Theodotus became paranoid and began refusing to come out of his apartments in the old Achaemenid palace. This made his loyal soldiers resentful and morale plummeted, leading to more open talk of accepting the bounty. Fearing assassination, Theodotus surrendered the city with barely a fight. With winter setting in, Lysimachus wanted to avoid a full occupation of his territory. So he crossed the Hellespont and marched south to meet Seleucus in battle near the town of Corupedion, west of Sardis. The details of the battle are frustratingly lost, but the age of the commanders is almost comical. Lysimachus was about 80 years old. Seleucus was 76 or 77. They both led their troops in the field, and Lysimachus died in battle. Whether that was from an injury or just because he happened to die of old age during the fight is unknown, but either is frankly possible. With their king dead, and the succession heavily disputed, the Lysimachid army surrendered with little more fighting. Most of Anatolia surrendered to Seleucus outright, aside from a brief Phrygian revolt, and the path to Europe was free and clear. They crossed the Hellespont that spring, and after Lysimachus' funeral, Seleucus had Alexander the Lysimachid assassinated, wiping out that dynasty for good. We've really narrowed the playing field in this episode. That's when Seleucus and Ptolemy Carinos marched into the city of Lysimachia. Remember, at this point, Lysimachus was the most undisputed king of Macedon as well. Cassander, Ptolemy, Antigonus, and Lysimachus were all dead. Seleucus was the last of Alexander the Great's generals still alive, and he had just killed the king of Macedon. He was in that king's capital, even if circumstance had shifted that city to Thrace. He was triumphant, victorious, and ready to be crowned once again. The only fragments of Alexander's empire still missing were Egypt and some weak Iranian kings in the mountains. Sure, he had lost India, but Macedon was incalculably more important. When he landed in Thrace, Seleucus set foot on European soil for the first time since leaving with Alexander the Great 53 years earlier. But before he left for that fateful campaign into the east, Seleucus had supposedly visited an oracle who told him, "Do not hurry back to Europe. Asia will be much better for you." Surely 53 years isn't a hurry, right? Well, just as Seleucus stood triumphant in Lysimachia, Ptolemy Carinos drew his sword and struck, claiming Thrace and Macedon as his own. It took a complicated and confusing route to get there, with many hurdles and obstacles, but in September of 281 BCE, Seleucus was about 77 years old. He had been king in Babylon for 24 years in practice, 30 years according to his own claims, and 42 years if you start with his arrival in the city as satrap. He was many things, Sharmat, Strategos, satrap, but most importantly, the king, Ho Vasilaos, and for a brief moment, he was Nikator, the victor of the Diadochoi. Next time, we turn our attention to those Iranian holdouts in the mountains and remote areas of the old Achaemenid Empire before moving on to the reign of King Antiochus I. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.